in Vancouver. When it comes to seaweed, Louis Druel is one of the world's experts. He's a scientist and former professor at Simon Fraser University, and his book, Pacific Seaweed, has sold over 10,000 copies. An updated version is about to be published. Well, he has a new book out, not so much about seaweed, although there is seaweed in it. It's called Cedar, Salmon, and Weed, but it's a very different type of book. It's Louis's first work of fiction, and it has deep ties to his personal life.
The particular incident that helped precipitate the book was the death of a very good friend of mine, John Boom. So he fell out of a boat one night and died of hypothermia, and he was quite young. And I really liked him, and I was very impressed by him. And I was also impressed by the village that we lived in, Bamfield. It's quite unique, and there's lots of stories there. So I thought I would try to write the book. And so I did. And,
which is in itself is pretty amazing. You just thought, I'm going to sit down and write this book.
Yeah. So the thing was that when I finished the book, I realized, and this is when I was really done, the publisher said, go away, we're not going to let you touch it again. I actually took the book away, and I sat down for the first time, and I read my book. I mean, it's always been going in and doing this, you know, doing little repair things. I sat down, and I read the book, and I thought, what I've done here is I've given my friend the life he didn't have.
What do you mean?
It just came to me.
What do you mean?
Well, I mean, he died young. He wanted to build a house. He wanted to have a girlfriend and a family. And, you know, he just wanted to have a life. So I gave him that. It's in the book.
And Gaz, the character in the book, is based on your friend John Boom.
That's right. Yeah.
Tell me a bit more about John before we move into the book.
Well, he was a Dutch immigrant. And he was very, very, very conservative. He was extremely smart. He was very strong, but he looked frail. One of these wiry guys, you know. So he was a student of mine. And we'd gone on a field trip to Bamfield. And we had a great time there. I always have fun with the students, and we always get some learning done as well. And we're coming back on the bus, and I'm sitting next to him. And he says, do you know how to clap? And I said, what? He says, do you know how to clap? And I said, yeah. So I clap, clap, clap. So he did stectetal between mine, right? And so all of a sudden, for 2 hours on the bus, we're racing through all this clapping. And after that, we became very good friends. Huh. We actually lived together for a while. So I kept track of him, and he and my wife got along extremely well. My kids adore him. They'll go to him if there's a problem. And that was very hard to say. It was just so much.
He just really just came into your life that way.
And that's right.
Touched you deeply.
Yeah, and he left my life that way too. Yeah.
Talk about, this is a book, well, I'm going to ask you to read here in a second, but this is a book, as you mentioned, which is so based in such a unique place, Bamfield.
Mm-hmm.
Talk a little bit about Bamfield and what it is like to live there.
Well, it's a little village at the end of 80 kilometers of dirt road. That's the start. That's where you get there. When you arrive, there's not very much you can do. If you don't know people, there's no restaurants or things like that. No theaters, obviously, or bowling. The people tend to be quite conservative, but friendly. And they have to do things or make their lives in a way that you don't have to in the city. I mean, if you say, what are we going to do tonight, for example, big question. In Bamfield, the answer is always have a dinner party. But in Vancouver, of course, you could have all these things you can do, right? So that's one thing. And then the other is you are a little more reliant on your own resources. And a lot of people do this because they choose to. You don't have to cut your own firewood. You can have gas or something to heat your house. You don't have to live in a shack, you know. But people select just to be kind of ornery about it, I think. Yeah.
Do you live there full-time now?
Yes, I do.
How long have you been doing that?
Well, I've been living there full-time for about the last 25 years.
And what is that like? Because you were here. You were living in the Lower Mainland.
Yes, yeah. I was a professor at Simon Fraser. Well, I just absolutely love it. The house I live in, I bought from a First Nation guy. And I was just going away on a trip. And John Boom called me up, and he said, Louis, there's a house for sale. It's got your name all over it. And I was going to go away for a year to Brazil the next day. And I said, go kick the tires. So he called me back, and he said, it's you. I said, it's mine. And I went away, and I came back a year later, and the people were still in it, thank God, because it was nothing like I'd ever experienced before. Yeah.
What a thing. You bought the house, went away for a year.
Yeah.
And then came back and finally saw it for, well, the first time, I guess, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Never been in it.
Did you fall in love with yourself right away?
Oh, yes. Yes.
Can you read the opening into your book, Louis? It just makes me feel like I'm, well, heading right into to Bamfield, which is something I've never done and have long wanted to do.
Well, you should do that. And you don't have to drive the road.
Oh, yeah. You can take the boat down,
the
right?
The ferry, yeah.
The Mary Rose.
Okay. So we'll start from the beginning.
Yes, please.
Yes, one. From Port Alberni, there are two roads. To the right, a paved road leads to the hippie driftwood shacks of Tofino. To the left, a dirt road disappears into the dense forest. This is the road to Bamfield. 60 miles strewn with beer cans, mufflers, hubcaps, and odd bits of clothing. Deep potholes, washouts, and oversized logging trucks, and countless unsigned side roads put those who dare journey to this fishing village in danger. But they come, those who seek the end of the road places. Having survived the Bamfield Road, newcomers find themselves on the Johnson Machine Shop dock, facing Bamfield Inlet. Here they can buy candy and gas and fishing gear and get their tires fixed. Katrine, the village matriarch and postmistress, works behind the counter, and she may jaw with them a bit. The August morning sun had warmed the gray boardwalk for over 2 hours before the first young Bamfielders left their houses and wandered, scratching and stretching and assessing the prospects of the new day, to their favorite hangout in front of the Bamfield General Store. Here they waited for opportunities to run errands for the storekeep in exchange for beer or in cigarettes, or helping summer residents haul luggage up from the government float for highly valuable cash. Mostly these hippies, locally referred to as transient young people, are accepted by the old-timers, many who are vets or war brides, and all who are conservative.
I just have this wonderful feeling of coming in on that road and then that the pace that changes so dramatically when you've gotten to the end of that road.
Mm-hmm.
Why did you want to set this novel in the 70s?
Well, that was a time when I discovered Bamfield. So I came down that road. And also I really like the idea of kind of sorting out what it is like to have these so-called transient young people interact with these very conservative fisher folk and shopkeepers and such. Because it was a time of turmoil.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is when the universities were having all their problems, like Berkeley and Simon Fraser, for that matter. So I'm just kind of curious to see how they would sort themselves out. Of course, they brought two cultures together. And maybe as you go through the book, you can see how those two cultures interacted.
What was it like? Tell me about what it was like the first time you saw Bamfield.
I'm going to make it the second time. The first time was kind of official. So when I actually settled in there, and I set up a lab in the manse of the United Church. Simon Fraser rented that from the church. And we went about our business. Now, that by this time, the village knew that the marine station was going to come. And so somehow we were put into a special position. So this one fisherman gave me a fish tote with a lid. He said, put this on your dock. So I put it on the dock. I had no idea what was going to happen. It turned out every morning I'd go down, I'd open it up, and there would be a meal. There'd be a salmon, or it'd be some crabs or clams. Sometimes there'd be some baked goods.
Oh, my heavens.
And the village really did welcome us.
This book, the landscape, of course, is such a vital part of this story. And mm-hmm. your descriptions of course, the sea life, so vivid, so incredible. Do you think that everyone who lives there is really observing, like so in touch with what's everything, the beauty that's around?
No. No, and sometimes I catch myself forgetting where I am.
Start to take it for granted.
Yeah. And it's, the flip side is true, too. When I was in Vancouver, I didn't take advantage of a lot of things. I would waste a lot of time. There might be a great show on or a dance or a concert or something. And out there, sometimes I just forget to look up at that sun going, you know, rising on the sky, or snow on the mountains glistening, or the water crashing.
Right. Have your neighbors been reading the book?
Yes, they have. And it's very interesting, you know, looking at them because... some of the characters, well, some of the characters hit pretty close to home, and I had them do things, of course, that they wouldn't or never did do. And but I haven't had a negative reaction to it yet.
But I'll bet there's lots of discussion about that character must be so-and-so,
oh,
right?
Oh, yes, yes. Yeah. No, that is really quite interesting to see. I kind of expected it, by the way.
And are they right, or are they mostly wrong about who is which?
They're mostly right.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So this experience of writing fiction, what did you think of it?
I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Yeah?
Yeah. I have a little shack next to our house. It's right on the water. I would go out there about 4 in the morning, every morning, and I'd work on my book. And I just got into the book. And so sometimes, I know it must have been rough for my wife, Ray. I'd go back in for breakfast kind of snarly, or maybe in happy mood, depending where the story was. You know? And it would be, it just so impressed me, the whole process. And just as an example, Ben, the First Nation guy, for about 2 years, every morning, just about sunrise, he would go by in the native fish boat right in front of my house and my shack, and I'd be there, and I'd wave at him, and he'd wave at me, and slowly he became Ben.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
He worked his way into the book.
He just worked his way into the book, yeah.
Don't you love when that happens?
Oh, I do, yeah. And it's there's things inside that you don't even know are there. It's good to give them a chance to try to come out.
And it's entertaining then, too, as you're writing, right?
Oh, yeah, of course.
Like, oh, who's this?
Yeah, no, I hate it when I start laughing. You know, you should never laugh at your own jokes, right? But I would just kind of, or I get really kind of melancholy. I think, well, this is really sad. And then I start to think, well, I actually created this.
Did you always think that this would come, this point in your life where you'd be writing fiction? Was that always a name that you had?
No.
No?
No, no. I flunked English. I didn't. And I mean, I was never, and still I'm not a voracious reader. And everybody says, you have to read, Louie. And I said, yeah, when I'm writing. You know? And but I mean, when I do read, I totally enjoy it. But no, I was a scientist for 35 years.
Right.
Yeah.
But you weren't harboring this secret desire to write a novel all that time.
No. It just kind of came out. And I think when I wrote Pacific Seaweeds, that was when the first time I could actually, I was writing my science, but I was embellishing
right.
it, you know, massaging it, making it more interesting. And so I think I kind of thought, well, what if I just went the next step, drop the science?
Thanks so much for coming in to talk about this.
My pleasure. Thank you, Cheryl.
That's Louie Drool talking about his novel, Cedar, Salmon, and Weed. He is a scientist and an author who lives in Bamfield, and his other book, Pacific Seaweeds, is about to be republished in an updated version.